Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago, I'm Gwen Macsai, and this is ReSound.
I can't be a father like this in my current condition and living the way that I was living. I really need to change. And so, man, what came with that was a whole lot of emotions. And I just didn't know how to say, this child is what's most important. I just didn't have the tools.
ReSound is a remix of audio stories, music, found sound, and sound bites we love from all over the world.
If we could have a pride event at the Pentagon, that would send a message to every single military installation all across the world that you can have one too.
Today, a story that goes into the heart of the military-industrial complex. And while there, they do ask and they do tell. Also, parenting behind bars, as if it's not hard enough in person.
We are so excited to be here to host the Third Coast Awards tonight.
We are, like, nerdily excited to be here. We got matching outfits.
Yeah, because, you know, the Third Coast Awards are sometimes known as the Oscars of radio. Except unlike the Oscars, people of color actually win here.
You burnt Oscars!
That was Kathy Tu and Tobin Low, hosting the 2018 Third Coast Awards ceremony in Chicago last October. Normally, they bring their crazy fun energy to their podcast, Nancy, a show of queer stories and conversations. In this episode, they visit possibly one of the squarest places on Earth, the Pentagon. Not the first place you'd think of when it comes to gay culture, but listen up, here it comes. Here's the Pentagon's secret gaggle of gays.
My name is Todd Brazil. I joined the Army out of college in 1992 as an Army lieutenant in the field artillery. I spent 22 years, 2 months, and 28 days in the regular Army.
And for most of those 22 years, he didn't tell anyone he worked with that he was gay.
None of my commanders ever suspected, and actually one of my troops who did suspect, who I think was gay also, he asked me if Dorothy was a friend of mine. He just immediately said, you know, are you a friend of Dorothy? So I'm like, I don't know her, man. And he was like, all right, sir, I was just curious, never mind. So it wasn't until years later when I found out that if you're a friend of Dorothy's, that's like a big indicator, you know. For 5 years, I was convinced I could either pray it away or get it counseled away by seeing an Army psychologist. So I thought, well, here's the deal. I will set about creating a life for myself where I have my personal life, and then I'll set up a very, you know, it's just this impenetrable wall between my personal life and my professional life, and my friends at work will be my friends at work, but they'll never really know who I am, and then my friends outside of work will know the full me. And then I met Mark. Mark and I were substantively engaged. We had exchanged rings for 11 years. For those 11 years, he followed me from assignment to assignment, waited for me while I went off to war a few times, and never received even a courtesy call, let alone any of the rights, benefits, and privileges of a lawfully recognized spouse while I served. What that man went through is something no one should ever have to go through. That hurt me watching what he was going through.
We begin tonight with something brand new in America today. It is day one.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell forced around 14,000 people to leave the armed forces because they are gay.
But today, the 17-year-old policy fought its last battle in the Senate.
With 65 votes, the Senate voted to end the ban on gays serving openly in the military.
Todd was out to dinner when he got a phone call from a friend.
And he called to let me know how the vote had gone down and that Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed. And immediately, like, my eyes welled up with tears. It's been repealed.
So this morning, I am proud to sign a law that will bring an end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Not long after that, Todd was posted to the Pentagon, high up in the communications department.
And just before going, a buddy of mine said, you know, there's this coffee group that meets in the Pentagon. They're all gay. It's civilians. It's people of all ranks. And it's a really great way to network. And you should give it a shot.
We were one part of a little budding gaggle of gays at the Pentagon. My name is Tariq Shah, and I was the Special Assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy. As they say in Washington, the longer your title, the less important you are.
I'm Alex Wagner. I am the former Chief of Staff to the 22nd Secretary of the Army.
Alex and Tariq were civilians appointed by the Obama administration, and they were regulars at the coffee club.
The Pentagon Coffee Group is a group of military officers and enlisted from every service who would come together to create a community within a building that at the time was openly skeptical at best and more likely hostile to their presence in uniform.
Even though Don't Ask, Don't Tell had been repealed, it's not like the military suddenly became a comfortable place for gay people. Unless you knew where to look.
Every Tuesday and Friday morning, we'd meet downstairs in the food court by the Dunkin' Donuts.
Laughing, smiling, and clearly not working. But it wasn't like someone put a big rainbow flag on the table.
The coffee club wasn't exactly secret, but Todd was definitely not interested. He still wasn't out to his coworkers at the Pentagon.
I am just coming out of this environment where being honest and behaving naturally was just so, not just frowned upon, but unlawful. But one day I'd happened to have a meeting get canceled, and I thought, you know what, I'm just gonna check it out. I walked the path to get to this place in the center of the Pentagon. I go down the escalator. And so I walk into the group, and I see some faces look up like, hey, man, welcome to Coffee Clutch. I just kept on walking. I just walked right through the group, and it freaked me out.
Alex and Tariq, the civilians, they knew that something extra needed to happen for LGBT service members to know it was okay to be themselves. Something public. Something official.
If we could have a pride event at the Pentagon, that would send a message to every single military installation all across the world that you can have one too. If it could be done in the heart of the Pentagon with the most senior uniformed and civilian leaders embracing and endorsing this type of event, it would be something that would be impossible to stop the momentum going forward.
So in early 2012, Alex and Tariq decided that they were going to organize a Pentagon Pride event that June, and it would be the first of its kind.
Tariq and I sat down and we shared a Burger King veggie burger and started plotting.
Wait. Burger King has a veggie burger?
Tobin, focus.
Tariq and I sat down and we shared a Burger King veggie burger and started plotting how we were going to execute a pride event in the Pentagon way.
The Pentagon way. This part of the plan was crucial. Whatever picture comes to mind when you think of a pride event, this was not what they were going for. For this to work at the Pentagon, it would have to be really square.
which meant have a ceremony in the Pentagon Auditorium with all the pomp and circumstance, but also with all the respect for tradition and history.
And so this incredible milestone in the history of the Pentagon would be marked by a panel discussion.
My motives here were not to have a pride parade in the Pentagon, but to have an event that resembled every other event the Pentagon held, whether it was MLK Month, Black History Month, Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, in a way that all those people could be proud of it. And so we started plotting.
The first thing Tarek and Alex had to do is build their team. And the first person they wanted to recruit was Todd.
An expert in thinking about how to message things.
Now, Todd still wasn't out at work, but he wasn't completely hiding it either.
At some point, he told me that he had taken Kathy Griffin to Afghanistan. And I remember going home that night and saying, Kathy Griffin is code word for something, but could he be gay?
I think I outed myself at the first meeting. But my gut reaction when Alex and Tarek brought me this was it's too quick. It's way too soon. This is a needless provocation. The ink isn't even dry on the repeal yet. Give it some time to kind of process.
I worked him over. I worked him over like any. I dealt with the Todds of the world before, and you know, I don't really take no for an answer.
It's like now is the time to put the accelerator pedal down and floor this son of a bitch, because people need to understand that the longer we push to the side and don't acknowledge, then the longer it'll take for people like your fiance and my friends to receive the full rights and benefits that they've earned.
We had to go way outside the chain of command in order to pull this off.
My name is Sue Fulton. I'm an Army veteran.
Sue was a pioneer in her own right as part of the first female class of graduates at West Point in 1980.
For many years, Sue was one of the more prominent voices advocating for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
My greatest shame in my life was the time when I was asked by a military investigator if I was gay at a time when I did know I was gay. And I lied and said no. I had survived the investigation. I'd managed to stay in. I'd managed to get out of the Army on my own terms. Many others had not. But I carried the shame and guilt for that for many, many years. And in one way or another, I've been advocating for LGBT people, particularly LGBT people in the military, ever since that.
Importantly, she also knows most of the Army's senior military leadership, so she had social relationships with many of the senior uniform generals.
Tarek told me of this ambitious plan to hold a pride event at the Pentagon that June. And I told him, hey, whatever I can do to help, I'd be happy to do. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, that's too early. It's not going to happen. I had to be persuaded to block the date on my calendar. I was that skeptical. And I'm an optimist. But it just, the Pentagon seemed so foreboding to me at the time. But I also knew that if anybody could pull it off, Alex and Tarek could.
So Tarek and I thought, well, what we'll do is we'll do this the way the Pentagon does its business.
We wanted to put it on paper.
We create a memo, a formal document that went up through the chain and got the right buy-in. So by the time it got to the secretary's office, this would have been an easy win. And so I assumed, and I think Tarek assumed, that this would be a no-brainer.
They followed all the official steps, and they waited, and waited, and waited.
You know you're not making headway in the Pentagon when your memo meets silence.
I recall various factions within the Pentagon sort of superstructure all but making it impossible for him to move forward.
I think a lot of people were genuinely concerned that a Pride Month event would look like the Fox News B-roll of a Pride parade.
The chiefs of staff of the Army, Navy, and Air Force and the Commandant of the Marine Corps categorically stood in lockstep against it.
It was just weeks till summer, just weeks till Pride, and they still didn't have the sign-off from their superiors.
I was so frustrated. The Tarek and I had done everything right.
We didn't have formal approval yet from the building.
But they weren't about to let this opportunity go. So the Pentagon's gaggle of gays took matters into its own hands, broke rank, went rogue, but, you know, Pentagon style.
So I found myself at a table at a meeting representing DOD, Department of Defense, at the National Security Council. And at the end of the meeting,
the discussion eventually came to a question to all of the national security agencies of how they were planning on celebrating Pride Month.
And the State Department said, oh, we're having another event with the secretary. And the Justice Department was very excited about the attorney general speaking at their event the year before. And it seemed like every federal agency was doing something for Pride Month. And then all of a sudden, it came to me. When you're sitting at a table at a meeting convened by the National Security Council, you're always going to be a little bit nervous. But I think adrenaline took over.
And so, you know, Alex reported that, you know, we were having a little trouble, that there was a plan in place to do a Pride event at the Pentagon, but that, you know, there was a question about whether it would actually happen.
And I said, well, I'd love the White House to light a fire under the department's leadership to make this happen. I was asking for something that was not in my specific marching orders. I could have been fired on the spot. I mean, if the Secretary of Defense said to the White House, fire him, boom. I later came to find out that the Office of Cabinet Affairs, the Office of Public Engagement, and the National Security Council came together at the White House to send a note to the Pentagon's leadership that they would like to see a Pride event happen.
I won't call it outside pressure, but what I will call it is a kind of wake the f*** up. Look at what's going on around you. Don't be the only, federal agency that attempts to squash an entire population of the people who work for you.
And we went from facing a few roadblocks to sort of the gates being open.
And when I got the email, it's on, you'll be getting your invitation shortly. I think I jumped up and said, you know, pumped my fist and then said to my wife, oh my God, Penny, they did it. They did it, and I'm going to speak at it.
It's the day of the event. We're excited, and we're really nervous.
The Pentagon Auditorium is downstairs. The stage is not very big. It's built for something like, you know, a panel of three or four.
The auditorium is filling up, and in the back of the auditorium, it turns out there are dozens of TV cameras. And they come from the military's own news reporting structure and from the national networks.
There was so much tension in the room. It felt a little like every straight person in the room was a little bit worried that people might think they were gay. And every gay person in the room was a little worried people might think they were gay. It's almost like, you know, on game day, you feel the tension and it's like it feels good because you know you're ready. That's how I felt. I felt like, okay, this is good. Give me the ball. I think back to when I arrived at my first duty station in 1980. One of the first people I met was our battalion PAC NCO, personnel NCO. And forgive the stereotype, but he was about 6'4", and he was the fiercest, most fabulous, you know, take no prisoners, flamboyant gay man I'd ever seen. And yet, all of the captains and majors and colonels deferred to him because he knew his job inside and out. He knew it better than anybody else. When he would pass me in the hall and say, "How you doing, ma'am?" You could see them all. They started to laugh and relax. The other folks would say, "Well, that's just Riley." And like, okay, this is going to be all right. And that was my intent. And from there, it was easy.
We can't believe it's going so well. We had a gay Marine who is active duty.
When the repeal happened, I went into work thinking that my life was going to change. And I went in and I sat down at my desk and I kind of braced myself on the desk waiting for everyone to come and ask me if I was gay.
We played the president's message for Pride Month.
As we celebrate LGBT Pride Month, we remember the activists and advocates who refused to be treated like second-class citizens.
It touched me. I mean, I get emotional to this day when I think about the growth that I watched happen on that stage. It absolutely changed me.
Seeing our friends in the Pentagon Auditorium was so celebratory and exciting. I mean, people with these huge smiles, people with tears in their eyes that we're here, this is happening.
I was sitting with my husband, the man I'd married just a couple months previous because it was no longer unlawful to do so.
And then the event, it starts with a presentation of the colors as the colors come down the aisle. And the fact that it was for Pride was so moving. To stand there and render honors, as I'd learned as a 17-year-old at West Point, knowing that this ceremony was celebrating something that I'd had to hide, was more, almost more than I could handle.
Yeah. It was one of the proudest moments of my entire life. It meant that we could never go back.
The Pentagon's Secret Gaggle of Gays was produced by Audrey Quinn for the podcast Nancy, co-hosted by Kathy Tu and Tobin Lowe. Coming up after the break, the hardest job in the world, parenting, in the hardest place in the world, prison. Back in a minute. ReSound is supported by Field Notes, vintage-styled, made-in-the-USA pocket notebooks and other stationery products. Weekdays at 401 North Racine in Chicago or anytime at fieldnotes.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to ReSound from the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. At Third Coast, we are constantly listening to podcasts, radio shows, everything we can get our ears on. And of all the stuff we hear, we share the very best with you.
When you were growing up, what was some advice your dad gave you?
Well, that's the problem. But my dad left when I was 4.
Yeah, the only advice I got from my dad was to be still and take this open like a man.
He used to show me what fork to use, like the crab fork, and we had all these like instruments of silverware out on the table. It took me a while to get the hang of that.
Oh, did my dad give me any advice? No, but he led by example of what not to do.
Welcome to Ear Hustle, a podcast that brings you stories of life inside prison, shared and produced by those living there. The podcast is a partnership between Nigel Poor, a Bay Area visual artist, and Erlon Woods, who was incarcerated at San Quentin State Prison. The series was co-founded with fellow inmate Antoine Williams. I say that Erlon was incarcerated because after serving 21 years of a 31 years to life sentence, Governor Jerry Brown of California commuted Erlon's sentence just before Thanksgiving, and he is now a free man. He's still working as a producer on Ear Hustle, of course, and the show will be following him as he begins his next chapter. But let's just say, never underestimate the power of a great podcast. So great, in fact, that the Ear Hustle episode Dirty Water won the 2018 Third Coast Festival Best Documentary Honorable Mention Award. On this episode, Nigel and Erlon talk to three people trying to make parenting work from inside prison. Here's Nigel and Erlon.
E, did your dad give you any good advice?
What do you mean, when I was like growing up?
Yeah.
Not that I can recall, but when I went to prison, he did say, watch your back.
Was that helpful?
I mean, it was cool coming from him, you know?
I guess it showed that he cared, right?
Pretty much.
Okay, well, being a parent is a lot more than giving advice. But if you're in prison, it's hard to even do that, because you're in prison.
Yeah, but you can actually give advice and be a dad from prison. It's harder, but a lot of guys here have children, and there's all sorts of different ways that they do it. And that's what we're going to hear about today.
And mainly, we're going to focus on this guy here.
So when I was told I was going to be a father, I started to think about what type of father did I plan on being.
Derek Holloway has been incarcerated for 21 years. When his son was born, Derek was a 24-year-old drug dealer and had a lot on his mind.
I can't be a father like this in my current condition and living the way that I was living. I really need to change.
But needing to change and actually changing your life, Derek now knows, are two different things.
You know, I'm at the hospital with his mom, and seeing his face was like, wow. It was like a miracle. It was like, man, this human being, I'm responsible for a human being. And so, man, what came with that was a whole lot of emotions. A whole lot that I wasn't even really prepared for or had even the emotional intelligence to even deal with it. And I just didn't know how to say, this child is what's most important. I just didn't have the tools.
In spite of being a new dad, he didn't change.
I started getting sucked in into the criminal lifestyle, criminal thinking, criminal behavior. After that, it was off to the dogs.
So give me a typical day. Like, what was you got up, and then how did the day unfold?
So I would get up, and of course I would, you know, have girlfriends strolled all over the city. So depending on what girlfriend house I was at, you know, so I would get up and kind of call around, see where everybody was doing, where everybody was going to be at. And I would, you know, hit the freeway, get to this block where everybody was at, kick back, see what was going on. So the typical day really was like me really making sure that the spot where we was at had dope out there. You know, people were out there, they were ready, the spot was rolling. And so I would kick it there for a minute, but I would always be trying to run and see what the next woman, what she was doing. Yeah, I just love women.
Derek was living a life. He was young, he had money, women. He thought he was on top of it all.
So the downfall was beginning really to use drugs.
And then he really got in trouble. In 1997, less than a year after his son was born, Derek was arrested for first-degree murder and sentenced to 37 years to life.
The next time Derek saw his son, he was in prison behind thick glass in a visiting room.
So he came to visit on his first birthday, and I'm just looking at him. And some of my thoughts was this glass going to represent our relationship? And, you know, for the first time, I was realizing and thinking, like, man, there's a possibility that I may never get an opportunity to see him as a child, man, grow up and have some kind of influence in his life.
Come on, know somebody can do better than that. Let's give the Lord a hand clap of praise.
Left to my own self, I couldn't find a way out. I wanted to do something different, but I didn't know how. And coming to prison actually really gave me that opportunity to sit down and really examine my life and to begin to get the courage and to do something different with my life.
I'm feeling good. I feel God. I feel God in here. I feel deliverance in here. I feel a breakthrough in this place. Whenever you talk about the...
In prison, Derek got religion, and he's now a prison preacher with a full-on congregation.
So if he put himself in prison, what prison are you talking about, Lord? He said, I went all the way down to hell, and I pulled the captives up, and I set them free. I did something that you can't do. Yes, you can
get... A lot of guys get religion, fake religion, act religious, but Derek's not. He's like the real deal.
How do you know?
Because you could sit in one of his sermons, and he'll just have a tear or two in your eyes, you know?
Really?
I mean, and he walked the walk. He don't just walk the walk on the pulpit. He walked the walk on the yard. And he go around and counsels people, counsels the youth. So, yeah, he's real.
But he couldn't counsel his own son. When his son's mother died, the boy's maternal grandmother took him in, and she thought it was best to keep him away from his father. And Derek only heard what was going on second and third hand.
So when he was growing up, I heard good things early on, you know, him being in church, and I would send him Bibles and him playing football and, you know, him going to different schools, academies. And then I started hearing different things about him being, you know, in the street life and going hard. And I was really disappointed. And even hearing that made me feel grief and pain. And
so he was basically growing up like you were.
Yeah, he was growing up like I was.
Derek was soon going to get a second chance to parent his son, and we're going to hear about that in a minute. But first, here's another prison dad with a very different experience of parenting from prison.
I could have been a dad at 17 and been just absolutely happy and dedicated, and I think I could have been a good pop, you know, as a kid. So it was something I wanted, and I was excited, confident, hopeful, and fulfilled.
John was 35 when his first child was born. When he committed the crime that led him to prison, his kids were 3, 8, and 9 years old.
It happened so suddenly. It was the night of December 20th, and I was coming back from a Christmas party, and it was one of those drinking and driving fatality cases. So I didn't have time to think, well, what would happen if I were taken away from my kids? That thought never occurred to me. It was just utterly, chillingly sudden. From the very beginning, being separated from them was the most gut-wrenching part of it. Besides, of course, what had happened, that two young, innocent lives were taken because of what I had done. I tried to be open with them about my responsibility. I tried to get them tuned into that, you know, not to thinking of me as a victim. And I think that made them a little more receptive to our parent-child relationship.
After John was arrested, he never went home again. He was a lawyer, middle class, but he couldn't make the $750,000 bail. The family life that he knew and loved was just gone.
But John was all about being a dad, and now he had to figure out how to do it from prison. Not easy.
I remember they came regularly in county jail when I was there, but of course you couldn't hug them there. It was through the glass.
After county jail, he got his sentence and was sent to a maximum security prison in Southern California. In that prison, his family could visit without glass between them.
I'll never, as long as I live, forget the visiting room at Lancaster. And I spied them across the room, and Remy, that my daughter, just ran towards me. And, you know, the feeling of hugging her. And then the boys joined me then, and I had my arms around all three of them. It might be the most emotional moment that I've ever experienced. There were so many hard parts about being away from the kids, but the biggest part was that I was so limited in how I could carry out what I still so fervently wanted to do as far as being a good dad to them. For the longest time, when they were small, I would write one letter a day and alternate amongst the three of them. Of course, each of them would be receiving a letter every 3 days. I remember with my daughter, Remy, she was the youngest, she was little, and I started a series of poems called the Silly Sally poems, and she got a real kick. She'd say, Dad, when are you going to, you know, I want some more Silly Sally. So I kept writing and writing. Finally, she got to be about 8 or 9 years old, and she was a little bit too old for that. But she talks about those still.
John's kids are all grown up now. They all went to college. The oldest is now 30. And if you're wondering what happened to their mother, she and John are still married.
I mean, I'll be very frank. It was much more important and much harder, you know, staying the meaningful father. I felt a much more biting, acute loss of the children than I did my wife, rightly or wrongly.
I didn't get a chance to really speak to him at 12 or 13 or get pictures or send stuff to him and just kind of communicate with him. I didn't get any of those things.
Back to Derek, who hadn't heard directly from his son in years.
The time that I heard that my son was even thinking about me is when he was in jail. So I get on the phone with my sister. And she says, I got something to tell you. Derek should be there, like, tomorrow. Derek should be there tomorrow. He called right before he left the county jail and said that I'm on my way to San Quentin.
Derek's son, who he hadn't seen in about 20 years, is coming to his prison. What are the chances?
Well, you don't see it a lot, but I've met a few guys who are locked up with relatives. But father and son, that's an entirely different level of weirdness.
I told a couple of my friends, I was like, man, my son is here. And so I went out that night to see if I can get just a glimpse of him.
So when his son first came to San Quentin, he went to reception, which is basically orientation. And those guys there don't wear blue. They're in the orange jumpsuits.
And I'm looking at every guy in orange as they're walking by. I'm kind of measuring their height because I hadn't seen him since he was like 11 months old. And so I'm like measuring the height, like, okay, looking at the walk, the build. I'm just looking at all these different things and these people trying to identify my son.
So you had no clue what he looked like?
I had no clue.
You had any pictures?
I had one picture, but he's 20 years old now, you know, and you're trying to see, like, what does a, from a, well, I think his last picture I got when he was, like, 6 years old. Like, so from 6 years old to 20, like, what has changed in all of those years?
You kind of walk in, I noticed him from the picture, even though it was old, I noticed him, and then he just came up and just gave me a hug and just started crying, breaking down.
That's Derek Jr. He's serving 5 years for robbery.
So when I looked at him and I just saw the love in his eyes, so kind of felt the connection right there. That's like, it's different. You talk to a lot of people, but you never actually feel that connection till you're sitting there with your dad. You never met him at all. And then you finally just sitting there eye to eye.
They saw themselves in each other, father and son. But really, they were strangers. All they had between them was some DNA and this old memory.
First memory of my dad I had was probably going to the jail and seeing the glass in the mirror and seeing somebody behind it. That's all I remember.
So he's talking and I'm looking at him, and And I'm in between our conversations of, you know, how, what has he been doing? You know, how is his girlfriend? How is my granddaughter? All of these different things. How's, you know, how's his grandmother? Asking him all these questions. In between those things was this reality setting in that I'm in prison with my son. And I'm trying not to let that affect me as I speak with him. But the reality of it just kept hitting me. I'm in the cell with my son.
So there they are, father and son, reuniting in a f***ed up place. I mean, prison is not set up for family life, that's for sure.
For Derek Sr., he had to figure out how to be a dad to his son in a way that he had never been able to do on the outside.
How am I supposed to show up now? Like, am I supposed to be like his partner? You know, am I supposed to be like dad? Am I supposed to be like my father? Like, what am I supposed to do? And it was so uncomfortable, but it was a good uncomfortableness. And it was like one of, it was like that kind of uncomfortableness, like when I walk away, like, I can't wait to be uncomfortable like that again. For me, right, the very first time that I heard Derek call me dad, it was as though God spoke to me and I turned around so fast before he even really can get it all the way out.
How does it feel to say dad?
At first it felt awkward, like, oh no, it felt awkward. Cause I ain't never said it. I had no reason to, so. And when I say it, I catch myself and I be like, oh,
after about 3 days after he was here, I went up to his cell and I said, Derek, come out. We was on the tier. I said, come out. And he came out of the cell and I said, your dad a kiss right here. And he kissed me on the cheek. I about ready to fly off the fifth tier. I was ready to just... Yeah. When he showed up here, that was like one of the things I had like on my calendar. Like, man, when is his birthday? So I made sure everything was all in place. Let me make sure I get this package right and make sure I get all this stuff right. So when it's his birthday, I'm gonna go make him something. Cause he had never really tasted my cooking.
Came up there, told me happy birthday, hugged me and kissed me, and then told me he was getting ready to cook. And I ain't never ate his cooking.
So what did he make for you on your birthday?
It was a rice bowl, but it had seafood. It had all different type of stuff and different type of vegetables and everything. Yeah, it was, I don't even eat vegetables. Yeah, but I ate them.
So I'm strolling, I'm coming down the back of the building. So the back of the building, I got to turn and go upstairs. So I'm turning, rolling. I see Big Derek and Little Derek in the shower. They side by side. Right? I'm like, that's you like 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oh. You looking at muscles gone. Stretched. I know, I was looking at him too. That's crazy.
That, yeah, because that wouldn't happen in too many places.
No, that wouldn't happen in too many places. You're just sitting there showering with your son. No. Y'all just, you know, cutting it. And they just.
And even that was awkward, man. You know that? But I had to force myself through it. Like, man, like, this is the reality, man. Like, man, I'm next. Like, where do they do this at? I watch him walk up the stairs sometimes, right? I'm walking behind. He always going faster than me. And I watch him go up. And I remember how I used to walk. And so when I watch him walk up the stairs, sometimes I'm like just staring at him like, man, look at me. That is me. And sometimes it is so overwhelming because nobody wants prison for their child. And so it makes me more protective. You know, now I'm more like, okay, where are you at? And I'll see him, but I don't let him see me. That brings up a whole nother thing. But yeah, just watching him, watching his mannerisms, how he interacts with people on the tier, how he interacts with people in the prison. Very outgoing. And I tell him this all the time. I say, you're just the functioning extrovert, because really you're an introvert like me. You really want to be by yourself. You really do good by yourself, but because we're outgoing people, we, you know, people talk to us and like us. And so I see that in him. But he has no problem being by himself.
We basically do everything just alike. When I get mad, I don't be bothered. I go outside at night, and I just be walking. And one night, I was just walking like, what the hell is you doing out here? He was like, man, I didn't feel like being bothered. And then we both ended up just being out there walking. Then we always just run into each other out there like, man.
I am nervous every time the alarm goes off. I am like, where is he? Is he involved? Is there a fight? you know. And so for me, it is an anxious day every day. Now I know what my parents went through. Wow, I'm serious. You reap what you sow, I'm telling you.
So we last heard from you in season one when we were talking about the Boom Boom Room.
Oh, yes. The Mission Impossible conception of my son.
That's Maverick. In season one, he told us how him and his wife decided to start a family while he was in prison. Here's a clip from that episode.
I had been at this prison for 2 years, and we had mastered the art of being intimate on the patio. It got us to talking, and she was like, I wish I could have a kid right now. And that got me to thinking. I'm like, oh man, this is the only thing that you can give her. You should go ahead and give her this. I would only get a visit like maybe once.
How old is he now?
He is 15 years old.
So he's a teenager.
Man, tell me about it.
Maverick's been in prison for his son's entire life.
But they have visits and phone calls.
And letters.
Yep.
That's what you gotta work with if you wanna be an active parent from prison.
And starting about a year ago, Maverick began having family visits. And that's one of the biggest privileges here.
It's huge. That's when your wife and your kids,
or it can be your parents and siblings, come to stay with you for a few days in a cottage here.
And we asked Maverick to tell us about the latest family visit he had with his wife and his son.
I cut his hair for the first time. And that's like a rite of passage for every father to cut his son's hair at some point in time. And he was scared at first because the whole month before the visit, I told him, you better not get your hair cut. Don't get your hair cut. I'm going to cut your hair. And he's like, oh, all right. You know, he was skeptical. And then I brought my clippers out. And when it came time to do it, I'm like, take off your shirt. And he's embarrassed because, you know, he's a little big fella for his age. And he's like, oh, and it was so funny. I'm like, boy, if you don't stop, I am your daddy. I gave you that, you know? It ain't no judgment. I ain't never gonna judge you. You are about to go to one of the most horriblest, cruelest places on the planet. High school. And some people gonna be making fun of your body. If you are embarrassed of your body, then kids are gonna use that against you. So you got to be comfortable in the skin you in. So just get comfortable. After I cut his hair, he went to look at it. And he was like, oh my goodness, Papa, this is great. You know, I got to pay $40 to get this hair cut. And I was like, yeah, boy. You're going to be able to get that every day when I come home. And it just gave me a glimpse of how thirsty he is to have a father in his life. But I believe that unsurety of exactly when I was going to come home, it was occupying too much of his mind. I got him worrying about me in here so much where he can't focus in class.
And that's what hurts me the most. Me not being able to help him process this. Me not being able to be there to just be there, to help him, to hold him, to let him know, look, it's going to be all right.
It's been a long struggle, but the good news is his son might have his dad home soon. Maverick has a date, which means he could be released on parole sometime this year.
Thanks for coming back. I know this isn't an easy one. So what we wanted to talk about was what happened with your son.
Yeah. Yeah, so actually got a call at work and said that they were ready to transfer Derek, and they were like transpacking him right now. So I needed to get there right away. Went back to the building, so his door is open, and I see a lot of boxes out in the front and some of his tubs, and you know, and it really began to sink in that he was getting ready to leave. And I had all these emotions going on, like, could I said something else? You know, what else could I have done? Should I have moved him in? You know, should I have been there a little bit more, kind of like fending off some of these bad people? I had all these emotions going, all these thoughts, all these feelings.
The reason Derek Jr. was transferred out of San Quentin is because he got in trouble for contraband.
And it was happening fast. So Derek Sr. went to go see him one last time.
Did he say anything to you?
Yeah, he just kind of looked, and I read his thoughts kind of. I looked in his eyes, and it was like, you know, Dad, I don't really want to leave. But I know I have to at this point. And they're waiting on me in R&R right now. I said, yeah, I know. I said, well, I'm going to help you carry your stuff down. And then when he comes out to actually leave, he has on his blue uniform, as I like to call it. And he had his hair up in the, you know, because he has his long hair. So he's got it up with these dreads. He's got it up in a ponytail, and I'm looking at him. We're standing at the end of the top of the stairs, and he hugs me, and he's like, Dad, I love you. And, man, he shoots down the stairs so fast. I'm trying to keep up when I realize how young. So he goes out the door, and I'm following him. I'm like, I'm going to walk down there with you. And he's walking down, and I remember studying everything about him. I actually walk behind him just to look at him. And I'm studying his body motion, his footsteps, and everything. Yeah.
Where did he go?
To Vacaville.
Which is a level 3?
Which is a level 3.
What's your biggest fear for him now?
That he won't make it out.
So as we said, Derek Jr. came in with a 5-year sentence, but Derek Sr.'s fear is that it could turn into a much longer sentence. I know you've said you've seen this happen to guys.
Yeah, I've seen a guy that came in with a car theft and committed murder in prison, and he's been here 46 years.
Right, he's still at San Quentin.
Still here.
So that's one big concern for Derek Sr. The other is he's lost daily contact with his son.
He told us he's waiting to get permission to exchange letters with him, but yeah, it's a blow.
The closeness that he achieved for the first time with his son isn't going to be easy to maintain.
It's not just that Derek Sr. is in prison, which is hard enough. His son's now in a different prison in a different part of the state. It's now like they have two thick layers of glass between them.
Thick Glass was produced by Erlon Woods, Nigel Poor, and Antoine Williams. From the studio at San Quentin Prison for Ear Hustle from Radiotopia. It's winter. I don't love snow, but I do love shoveling. Part of it is compulsive. I like to get out there before anyone has walked on the pristine powder, tamping it down and making it impossible to scrape off the sidewalk smoothly. And part of it is the clarity and speed of the job. Half an hour and you've accomplished a great deal. Unless maybe, say you're in New Hampshire. It's a really fast falling snow and you finish only to have to start all over again. In Sean Hurley, I have found a soulmate. Here is Still Life with Shovel.
The snow falls. The storm ends and starts again. I plant my shovel in the snow pile, like a flag on the moon of winter. Take my boots off, put them back on again. The plows shudder by and shudder by, on snow-chained tires and spitting sand. And I have no plans to lean the shovel in its summer spot behind the house. I remember shoveling the family driveway in the blizzard of 78. I was 11 years old and knew I was shoveling legendary snow. In fourth grade, we had to learn to spell the word Samaritan. The teacher told us what a good Samaritan was, and I wondered about the existence of such a peculiar and helpful person. Was I a good Samaritan? Early one morning in the snow, I was 10, I went down the street and shoveled the walkways of my older neighbors. Good Samaritan. That great pair of two good words ran in circles around my head, like a halo in the making. But this was also the counter magic to a summertime habit I regularly indulged. The bad Samaritan game of Ding Dong Ditch. I hoped as I shoveled that someone would catch me being so good. They would smile from a window or come down and try to give me something. I would accept an English muffin or hot chocolate, but I would refuse all offers of money. I would brush off any thanks, disappear as quickly as possible, late for my next appointment with utter goodness. But no one noticed, and later I waited to hear the powerful rumors of the mysterious shoveler. But there was nothing. Apparently, good Samaritans can go unseen, unspoken of. It must be too late, but I still want to tell them, it was me, you fools, who shoveled your walk in the late 70s. And also, by the way, it was me ringing your doorbell. All those times there was no one there. I'm sorry about that. And yes, I'll take an English muffin. I've always shoveled where I've lived, but when we moved to Thornton a decade ago, there was already a neighbor long used to plowing out our horseshoe driveway, so I let it go. But we had our walkway, 4 feet wide by 10 feet long, and I had my Samaritan's history with walkways. I make a big deal of what I've got left, the shoveler's equivalent of a comb-over. A postage stamp I can clear in a single minute. But I am still a shoveler, a veteran of the Great Blizzard of 78, unrecognized walkway Samaritan of the year before. The plows shudder by and shudder by. I plant my shovel in the snow pile, like a flag on the moon of winter. Boots off and on. The storm ends and starts again. And I have no plans to lean the shovel in its summer spot behind the house.
Still Life with Shovel was produced by Sean Hurley for New Hampshire Public Radio. Check out Sean's Third Coast Short Talk winner, My Life as a Cup, when you visit our website, thirdcoastfestival.org. You've been listening to Resound from the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program is produced by Isabel Vasquez and curated by Johanna Zorn and Maya Goldberg-Safer. You can hear today's program at thirdcoastfestival.org, where you can also hear more than 2,000 outstanding documentaries from around the world and subscribe to our podcast. Support for Resound comes from Emma, a web-based email marketing and communication service helping businesses and nonprofits manage their email campaigns and online surveys in style. More at myemma.com. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Agudino Foundation, the Menache Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Illinois Arts Council Agency. Special thanks to our many individual contributors from Chicago and around the world. The Third Coast Festival, now an independent arts organization, was originally founded at WBEZ Chicago. Want to stay up to date on the latest Third Coast happenings? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to our newsletter at thirdcoastfestival.org. With so much to listen to and so little time, ReSound. All diamonds, no rough.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.